Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Joining us for this post-argument episode of SCOTUScast, Securities Litigation, Statutory Interpretation, and Subject Matter Jurisdiction Edition. I'm your host, Bridget Flaherty. On November 28, 2017, the Supreme Court heard argument in Scion, Inc. versus Beaver County Employees Retirement Fund, a case involving a dispute over the concurrent jurisdiction of federal and state courts regarding class action lawsuits that allege securities law violations. In 1995, Congress enacted the Private Securities and Litigation Reform Act, PSLRA, to address various abuses then taking place with respect to securities litigation. When plaintiffs then proceeded to file securities actions in state rather than federal courts in an effort to avoid PSLRA restrictions, Congress enacted the Securities Litigation Uniform Standards Act of 1998, SLUSA, to prevent certain state private securities class action lawsuits alleging fraud from being used to frustrate the objectives of the PSLRA. Among other things, SLUSA amended the concurrent jurisdiction of federal and state courts over enforcement suits under the 1933 Securities Act to accept covered class actions, which were otherwise provided for in Section 77PC of the Act. That section precludes covered class actions alleging state law securities claims and permits precluded actions to be removed to and dismissed in federal court. In 2014, Beaver County Employees Retirement Fund brought a covered class action against Scion in California Superior Court, alleging violations of the 1933 Securities Act's disclosure requirements. The fund alleged no state law claims, only the Federal Securities Act's violations. Arguing that the state courts lacked subject matter jurisdiction over the federal claims in the wake of SLUSA, Scion sought judgment on the pleadings. The Superior Court denied relief, following precedent from the California Court of Appeal for the Second District, indicating that concurrent jurisdiction of a covered class action alleging only claims under the 1933 Act survived the amendments that SLUSA had made to that statute. The California Court of Appeal for the First District affirmed the Superior Court, and the Supreme Court of California denied further review. The U.S. Supreme Court then granted certiorari to resolve whether state courts lack subject matter jurisdiction over covered class actions that allege only claims under the Securities Act of 1933. And now, to discuss the case, we have Thea Brooknight, Associate Director of Financial Regulation Studies at the Cato Institute.
Chief Justice Marshall famously declared that it was the duty of the judiciary to say what the law is. While the exercise of this duty may in practice run the gamut from strict textualist interpretations of statutes to more fanciful ruminations on living documents, it cannot be denied that statutory interpretation is at the heart of a jurist's duty. In theory, the justices of the Supreme Court should be among those best able to divine the meaning of a given piece of legislation. But a case now before the Supreme Court may sorely try the justices' abilities to do just that. In oral argument, Justice Alito all but threw up his hands, calling the relevant statutory language gibberish. The case is Scion v. Beaver County Employees Retirement Fund. The facts are very simple. Scion, a corporation, issued securities which subsequently declined in value. A class of investors brought suit alleging violations of the Federal Securities Act of 1933. They brought the suit, however, not in federal court, but in California state court. Scion wants to remove to federal court, the class of investors does not. Typically, the fact that the case arises under federal law would be sufficient for removal, but the 33 Act is unusual in that it expressly grants concurrent jurisdiction between state and federal courts. Except in some cases. But here's the crux of the case. There's an exception, but no one can figure out what that exception includes. That's the question presented in Scion. Does the class action brought by the investors fit within this exception, or may it be heard by the state court in which it was brought? Even though the case was brought in state court, it includes no state claims whatsoever. It alleges only 33 Act claims, making the question fairly sharp. So what's the answer? to begin to understand the question, we have to start with a little history. In the 1990s, two laws were passed to address perceived problems with securities class actions. First, Congress passed the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act, or the PSLRA. This was intended to curb the use of class actions by imposing certain obligations on plaintiffs, such as heightened pleading standards. The result was that many lawyers started bringing cases in state court. The 33 Act's concurrent jurisdiction permitted this, and state courts were not bound by the provisions of the PSLRA. So in response, Congress passed the second law, the Securities Litigation Uniform Standards Act, or as it's known, SLUSA. Why are we talking about the history at all? Why not just read the statute, you know, like lawyers, and see what it says? The problem is the one Justice Alito so elegantly identified. The statutory language is gibberish. We have one provision that purports to establish jurisdiction. And to fully understand the case, you might want to just read along. It says, "The district courts of the United States and the United States courts of any territory shall have jurisdiction of offenses and violation under this subchapter and under the rules and regulations promulgated by the commission in respect thereto, and concurrent with state and territorial courts, except as provided in section 77P of this title with respect to covered class actions of all suits in equity and actions at law brought to enforce any liability or duty created by this subchapter, except as provided in section 77PC of this title, no case arising under this subchapter and brought in any state court of competent jurisdiction shall be removed to any court of the United States." So, leaving aside the exceptions, the language is actually straightforward. There is concurrent jurisdiction between state and federal courts over cases arising under the 33 Act or under any rules the SEC issues pursuant to the same act. And such a case cannot be removed from state to federal court. What is at the 77P then, which is what is quoted in the exceptions? Given the language I just quoted, we would expect 77P to include some statement about jurisdiction over covered class actions. Covered class actions, by the way, are defined essentially as class actions involving more than 50 people. This is not terribly relevant because no one in Scion disputes the fact that the class action is a covered one. But what about jurisdiction over such class actions? Section 77P is actually silent on this. It bars covered class actions in which the plaintiffs allege claims substantially identical to those arising under federal law. That is, plaintiffs cannot simply dodge federal law altogether and make the same claims, but just under state law. So specifically, Section 77P states, "No covered class action based upon the statutory or common law of any state or subdivision thereof may be maintained in any state or federal court by any private party alleging an untrue statement or omission of a material fact in connection with the purchase or sale of a covered security, or that the defendant used or employed any manipulative or deceptive device or contrivance in connection with the purchase or sale of a covered security." But that provision simply bars some types of cases and says nothing about a case like the one at issue in which the plaintiffs have alleged only federal claims. The other exception mentions 77PC. So what about 77PC? Does that help? That provision states, quote, "Any covered class action brought in any state court involving a covered security, as set forth in subsection B," which is what I just read previously, "shall be removable to the federal district court or the district in which the action is pending, and shall be subject to subsection B," end quote. It's not clear that that subsection is very helpful, because subsection B bars this type of class action alleging only state claims, at least if they're functionally identical to the federal ones. Read one way, and perhaps the most natural way, this provision means that cases that are already barred by another subsection can be removed to federal court. But how could a case that is barred be removable? Shouldn't it just be thrown out? But that would make this subsection, subsection C, superfluous. And if we read like good lawyers or jurists, we are not to read a statute as to make any part of it superfluous. So here's the problem. The first provision, which is at 15 U.S.C. section 77V, says that there is concurrent jurisdiction for state and federal courts. except in some subset of cases involving covered class actions. We have here a covered class action. But when we go to the section that should have the exception, 15 U.S.C. Section 77P, it includes nothing that squarely addresses the issue. It's as if the first provision said, the price of apples shall be as set as described in 77P, and then 77P only talked about how to calculate shipping charges for bananas. Oftentimes, jurists use oral argument less as a means of developing their own understanding of the case and more as a means of eliciting arguments from counsel that the judge feels will best sway recalcitrant brothers and sisters on the bench. There was very little of that sort of gamesmanship going on during this oral argument. More than anything, the justices seemed to be imploring counsel, any counsel, to provide something to hang their hats on. And yet, the justices overwhelmingly seemed unsatisfied with anyone's interpretation. They were unhappy with interpretations from Scion, from the investors, and from the government, who also weighed in on the case as an amicus. Scion's counsel, Neil Katyal, argued that the provision should be read to affect the purpose of SLUSA, which was to prevent plaintiffs' lawyers from circumventing the PSLRA's heightened standards for class actions. Justice Ginsburg remarked, though, that, quote, Congress chose a rather obtuse way of saying that federal courts shall have exclusive jurisdiction, quote. Mr. Katyal agreed, noting that Justice Ginsburg and her colleagues, quote, could have written a much better statute than our friends across the street, meaning Congress. Given the question's focus on statutory interpretation, it would be reasonable to expect that oral argument would be down in the weeds parsing the statutory language. But this argument was really in the weeds. The government's lawyer, Alan Kedem, had a lengthy back and forth with Justices Breyer and Kagan over the rule of last antecedent and whether as set forth in subsection B modifies any covered class action or as set forth in subsection B. Justice Alito got to the heart of the matter, saying that all of the readings that everybody has given to all of these provisions are a stretch. Although that remark was met with laughter, presumably many of those attending the argument felt as lost as the justices, Justice Alito followed up with a more serious question, asking, is there a point at which we say this means nothing? We can't figure out what it means, and therefore it has no effect? It means nothing? Mr. Kedem cautioned the court against such an extreme measure as what would amount to congressional nullification. And yet, it does present a real question about the duty of the judicial branch and the limits of that duty. Is it worse if the court fails to give effect to something duly enacted by Congress, or for the court to effectively make up what it imagines Congress intended because it cannot be truly certain what Congress did intend? The former would at least have the advantage of encouraging Congress to be careful in its lawmaking, although it could provide too convenient an escape hatch for a judge who objects to a law. It is ultimately likely a philosophical question rather than a practical one, since it's unlikely that that will be the path the court takes in this case. But if a jurist were a strict textualist, what is that jurist to do? Justice Alito conjured the spirit of his late colleague, noted textualist Antonin Scalia, referring to Justice Scalia's book, Reading Law, for guidance in determining what to do when Congress writes gibberish. Mr. Katyal remarked that in that book, Justice Scalia advised, if you really can't figure it out, then you look to, for example, the statutory findings. Even as a textualist, you look to that and find out what Congress was getting at. Thomas Goldstein, counsel for the investors, fared no better in argument than Mr. Kedem or Mr. Katyal. He advised the court that it might reserve the removal question for another day, finding that disrupting state jurisdiction is too great a feat to be accomplished with inscrutable language. Even if that means finding effectively that the except language targets a null set. That interpretation roused Justice Gorsuch to employ Justice Alito's gibberish accusation, asking, Mr. Goldstein, speaking of gibberish, aren't we stuck with gibberish your way too? I mean, it seems like it's gibberish all the way down here because under your version, that first except clause is superfluous. It doesn't do anything. A few moments later, he noted that it is our job to try and give effect whenever possible to Congress's language. It's not for us to assume that Congress's language means nothing and was a waste of time. After more back and forth, during which Mr. Goldstein presented arguments and Justice Gorsuch batted them away as against precedent, Justice Gorsuch pleaded with Mr. Goldstein, work with me, all right? asking Mr. Goldstein to walk him through some interpretation that might be plausible. After more attempts by Mr. Goldstein, Justice Gorsuch threw up his hand, saying, "You haven't helped me out much there." The investor's bigger point, however, was that all the provisions at issue were not aimed at 33 Act claims at all, but were simply trying to ensure that all 34 Act cases wound up in federal court, even those that included a 33 Act claim. Justice Ginsburg asked whether that made any sense, given the concerns about uniform adjudication of federal securities claims, including 33 Act claims. Mr. Goldstein responded that legal uniformity mattered more than procedural uniformity, and in that case, the state courts would apply federal law to 33 Act claims, and so concern about uniform application of law would be met. Cyan's response to this argument was simply that if you look at the congressional history behind SLUSA, it is concerned with the removal of these cases, the fact that lawyers were trying to circumvent the provisions of the PSLRA by going to state court. In the end, it is not clear that any party presented the court with a home run. I, for one, pity the justice and his or her clerks who draw the short straw and have to write this opinion. It will not be an easy task.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's FEDSOC.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.